As you listen to today's Politics Monday, take a second and tap that donate button on the WFAE app or go to WFAE.org and make a contribution during WFAE's spring membership campaign. Whatever fits your budget, that amount goes towards something here at WFAE, like the server space for this podcast. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. It's Politics Monday, and today we focus on a topic that both remaining Democratic candidates have plans for, but you may not know about much about them because there hasn't been much discussion about it in the debates. Affordable housing. Tom Steyer was asked about the topic in November's debate on NBC.
Mr. Steyer, millions of working Americans are finding that housing has become unaffordable, especially in metropolitan areas. It is particularly acute in your home state of California and places like Los Angeles and San Francisco. Why are you the best person to fix this problem?
When you look at inequality in the United States of America, you have to start with housing.
Charlotte and other cities have been grappling with how to increase the number of affordable or workforce housing units available and working to maintain the stock we already have as this roaring economy encourages and enables development and gentrification. Both Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders have plans to help in that effort. Former Vice President Biden would spend more than $500 million on housing initiatives.
Housing should be a right for people. The idea that you have so many people on the street in California because of the increase in cost of housing, it's just not right. And we're going to fully fund housing, and we're going to make sure that everyone has access to Section 8 housing. No one should pay more than 30% of their income for housing.
Senator Sanders would pump more than $1 trillion into the National Housing Trust Fund.
It is not acceptable to me that so many of our people are spending half of their limited incomes on housing. It is certainly not acceptable that 500,000 people are sleeping out on the streets. As President of the United States, we will end that disgrace. We will build the affordable housing that this country desperately needs.
But if elected, would either of these candidates' proposals make it through Congress? What impact would they have if enacted? And when would cities like ours feel the effects? To help us explore that, we've invited Jenny Schutz to join us. She is a fellow at the Metropolitan Policy Program Future of the Middle Class Initiative at the Brookings Institution in Washington, where she is with us this morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Diane Yentel is the president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition, which is dedicated solely, in their words, to achieving socially just public policy that ensures people with the lowest incomes have affordable and decent homes. Thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And if you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Diane, let me begin with you. Affordable housing has become a critical problem in many communities, including ours, and for millions of people in America, too. All the Democratic candidates had plans, although we didn't know much about them, to address it, and it did come up in a couple of the debates, but only for a short time. Clearly, this is an issue where with the moderators more than anything else, because they decide what the candidates are going to get asked. Why has this topic been overlooked by professional journalists quizzing these candidates? Are they unaware of the problem?
You know, I think moderators are generally aware of the problem. I think certainly the general public is aware that we are in the midst of a housing crisis and that it's worsening and that homelessness is increasing and becoming increasingly visible. I think people understand that there is a crisis and we need to hear policymakers talking about their solutions. And although it's certainly we're not yet hearing politicians talking about it to the degree that we want to, they're talking about it more than we ever have had presidential candidates talk about housing in presidential campaigns in the past. And the moderators, you played a great clip. It was a big breakthrough moment in that debate in Atlanta when the moderator asked that question about which candidates were the best to address the affordable housing crisis, that's the first time, I think, in history that we've had a presidential debate moderator ask an affordable housing question to presidential candidates. And in other debates, while moderators haven't asked the question, the candidates have gone out of their way to talk about the crisis and the solutions. That was especially the case in the New Hampshire debate. And then just recently in South Carolina, we had another moderator question to candidates about the housing crisis, and we had a pretty substantive exchange between the candidates about their differing, to some degree, solutions. So, you know, we still haven't reached the degree, I think, that we need candidates to be prioritizing these solutions, but we're certainly hearing them talk about it more than we ever have before in presidential elections.
And there's a reason for that. Jenny, it's a concern for young people. It's a concern for middle-class people. It's certainly a concern for poor people. It's a concern for policymakers at the city and county levels across this country. We're still having political conversations about health care, but is this the new health care? Will this become the topic of real importance in the next 4 to 8 years?
Absolutely. And for households, this is a particularly salient issue because everybody needs a place to live. Everybody pays the rent or the mortgage month to month. And actually, for most households, the money that they spend on housing is the single largest budget item that they pay every month. So this is an issue that households are keenly aware of and are paying attention to. I think one of the reasons why we haven't heard as much about it in the presidential debates is that we tend to think of solutions to housing as being a local issue. Local governments are in charge of setting the rules by which housing can be built, where it goes. And so the federal government provides subsidies, particularly for low-income households, and of course, a regulation of the mortgage market, which is really important for homeowners. But a lot of the day-to-day conversations about what housing gets built and how much it costs are happening at the mayoral level or at city councils. But what we're seeing now is both that the affordability crisis is reaching higher up in the income distribution and that local regulations around housing supply are starting to have regional impacts on the economy, especially in places like California, Seattle, Boston, D.C. So the federal government, in part, is getting more involved in those conversations because we're becoming aware of the macroeconomic impacts of not building enough housing and of people not being able to afford to live where they want to live.
So before we talk about the solutions being put forward by both of the remaining Democratic candidates, let's talk about the problem. When did the challenge of finding safe, affordable, or workforce housing become a problem? Why is it becoming a problem? Has it always been with us, or is this a recent development? And I'd like to hear from both of you. I'll start with you, Jenny.
Poor families have always had trouble paying for housing that they can afford. So the poorest 20% or so of families are spending more than half of their income every month just to pay for housing. And many of them are living in poor quality housing, far away from jobs and transportation, in neighborhoods that don't have a lot of economic opportunity. What we're seeing that's different is in the past, say, 8 to 10 years, as we've come out of the Great Recession, housing affordability is increasingly a problem for middle-income households, particularly for renters who tend to be younger, are more likely to be poor, or more likely to be non-white. And this is a particularly acute problem in the cities that have the hottest labor markets, that have well-paid jobs, and people want to move there in order to take these jobs. But housing costs are so expensive, it's increasingly hard to do that.
Jenny? I mean, Diane, what's your take on that?
So at the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, we focus on the lowest income renters, people who are deeply poor. They're seniors, they're people with disabilities, they're families with young kids. Their combined family income is no more than like $25,000 a year. And for them, the housing crisis has been around for a long time. Today, we have a shortage of 7 million homes that are affordable and available to them. So another way of saying that same number is for every 100 of those extremely low-income renters, there's about 35 homes that are affordable and available to them. And that shortage ranges from most severe to least severe, but there's no state and there's no major metropolitan area that has a sufficient number of homes that are affordable and available for those lowest-income renters. Now, that severe shortage of homes for those lowest-income people, one, it's the main reason why there are income challenges or challenges with paying the rent up the income ladder. It all starts with that shortage of homes for the lowest income people. And we haven't always had that severe shortage. We could go back to a time not that far ago in the late 1970s when we actually had a slight surplus of homes that were affordable and available to those lowest income people. At that time in our country, we were housing nearly everybody. The kind of homelessness that exists today in our communities didn't exist back then. And the main difference between then and now is federal funding for solutions that keep the lowest income people affordably housed. We had a big cut to those solutions back in the 80s, and we've never really recovered the level of funding and the level of targeting for solutions to be affordable to the lowest income people since then. So we've had this steady increase. And as Jenny said, incomes is certainly an issue as well. We look at how the lowest income renters can't afford the rent. It's partly a challenge that housing is so affordable. It's partly because jobs, the kind of jobs that our economy is creating, are predominantly low wage jobs. So low income workers don't make enough to be able to pay the rent.
And Diana, I only have 10 seconds left, but why were those cuts made in the late 70s, early 80s?
Oh, I think it'll take more than 10 seconds to answer that one.
Just take a few more seconds.
Largely a matter of ideology, I think, and priorities about where, who, and how should be housing the lowest income people.
Diane Yentel is president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Jenny Schutz is with us. She's with the Brookings Institution, and we will continue in a moment at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about affordable housing, which is not only an economic issue, it's a public policy issue, and we're talking about this with Diane Yentel, the president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. She joins us from Washington by phone. Jenny Schutz is sitting in a studio at the Brookings Institution, where she's a fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program Future of the Middle Class Initiative. Unrest in the middle class, Jenny, has certainly been a modern driver of our politics. But are the people who gravitated toward Donald Trump in the last election, and still do, and those who are enamored, for instance, this time with Bernie Sanders, struggling to find affordable housing, or is that a different subset of our electorate? Are the people who are up in arms about where we are today economically in America mad about housing, or are they mad about other things?
There's certainly a lot of people who are angry about housing who are attracted to Bernie Sanders' message. So one of the things that you can see in sort of the language that he uses to talk about affordable housing is that he puts the blame on what he calls corrupt developers and speculators. So he's pushing back quite hard against the idea that there are for-profit companies making money off of real estate, both building it and as landlords owning it. And at the same time, there are people who can't afford a place to live. So particularly in places like the West Coast, where housing costs have become very expensive, and it's clear that people who own real estate are doing very well from this, while tenants are having a hard time paying the bills, Bernie's message is very attractive. He's suggesting that we should think about housing not necessarily as a for-profit industry, but as a human right, and that perhaps the government should take more aggressive measures to limit the ways that landlords can make profit off of owning rental buildings.
While you're talking, let me ask you this. Have Republicans focused on this issue? We talked about Bernie. Have Republicans done anything? What has been the Trump administration's record on addressing affordable housing, Jenny?
So the Trump administration hasn't made housing a particular priority. This isn't an issue that comes up frequently in the president's speeches. And Diane can probably give more details. The administration's budgets each year have proposed cutting the funding for HUD pretty substantially, reducing the funding both for public housing, for programs like the Community Development Block Grant that goes to mayors to do quite a number of things. So the administration has been pushing back on a lot of the social safety net housing that we have, One sort of interesting thing is that the administration has come out and said that we need to focus on the regulatory barriers that exist at the state and local level that are making it harder for housing to get built. And so that's an issue that crosses over both parties. Democrats have been focusing on it because it can help with housing affordability. And a number of Republicans beyond just the president have been focusing on this because they see it as excess government and excess regulation.
So, Diane, according to your organization... Sure, go ahead.
I'm just on the part about it, Republicans, to say that, to the extent that Donald Trump or Ben Carson, the HUD secretary, Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, have focused on housing at all, it's been to promote or push forward policies that would actually exacerbate the housing crisis, whether through eliminating or drastically cutting funding for programs that keep the lowest income people affordably housed, or through pushing forward really harmful policies that would raise the rents for the lowest income and some of the most vulnerable HUD tenants, or even to evict tens of thousands of children from affordable housing. So their actions have really been to roll back progress and harm low-income renters through deep cuts to the programs that house them.
You have described the president's approach as, and this is your word, callous. Is this mm-hmm. deliberate, or is it out of a lack of understanding of the problem?
Well, when it comes to the president, I'd say probably both. When it comes to the Secretary of HUD, I'd say that he does understand the importance of the programs that he proposes eliminating, and often gives very mixed messages about why he wants to eliminate them. On the one hand, he needs to support these proposals because it's his budget and he is a cabinet member of this administration. He works for the president. On the other hand, he'll say, well, we're just proposing this, and Congress ultimately will make the decision about whether these programs get cut in the end. But certainly when the Secretary of HUD proposes evicting 100,000 low-income people, including 55,000 American kids that are part of certain immigrant families, as he has done, I do think that that's callous. I think it's cruel, and I think it's very harmful to those individual families, to their communities, and to our country's efforts to end homelessness.
And as we
but
have learned...
I also want to say that other Republicans, there are Republicans in Congress who have been champions for some affordable housing programs, whether it's through funding those programs through appropriations or actually even of late, Republican senators who are working with us to expand funding for key housing programs. And as Jenny said, many Republicans are unfortunately relying on this idea that deregulation or removing restrictive zoning laws, which are important, an important part of the solution, they're increasingly relying on it as though it is the entire solution, and it's not.
So let's talk about that, Jenny. Some see this as a problem, as she just said, of zoning and reducing regulation. Greg Brown, the Senior Vice President for Government Affairs at the National Apartment Association, says if you can break down some of the physical barriers and the regulatory barriers to the development of a new supply of affordable housing, you can address the challenge. Is overregulation the problem?
Overregulation is certainly part of the problem, but Diane's right that it's not the entire problem, and especially for low-income households, just fixing regulations is not going to be enough. What we've seen over the past, say, 30 years or so, is that local governments have made it increasingly hard to build new housing, and particularly to build apartments. So cities and suburbs have created these systems where building a new apartment building requires a lot of discretionary approval. Neighbors can show up and say, I don't want new housing in my neighborhood. I don't want lower-income people in my neighborhood. I don't want more cars and more traffic. And the reason why it's really important that most of the restrictions are on apartments is that that's the most affordable kind of housing, and that's how you allow more people to live on expensive land close to jobs and transportation systems.
Let's clear that up for a second. When you say apartments, are you talking about apartments in general or apartments specifically built for affordable housing?
The regulations say apartments. So zoning tends to regulate types of new housing by the structure. So single-family detached houses can be built in most residential areas without jumping through all of these extra hoops. But to build an apartment building, even something as small as a four-unit building up to, you know, a high-rise, apartment buildings require extra permission, less land is allocated to them, and that applies equally to a low-income housing apartment complex, right, or to a luxury condominium complex. But the structure type is much harder to build than a single-family detached house.
You need to come to Charlotte, where apartments are sprouting up like there's no tomorrow. But the problem with those apartments is that they're all luxury apartments. Very few of them have units set aside specifically for affordable housing needs. And some areas have relied on something called inclusionary zoning regulations that require developers to set aside a percentage of new units for affordable housing. That is not legal in North Carolina, and municipalities like ours cannot mandate that. Charlotte has to rely on incentives for developers and their goodwill, and that, you're going to find this hard to believe, doesn't always work. Can the market, Jenny, work on a challenge like this? Or if we're serious about solving this problem, must we have government intervention?
The market by itself can't produce housing that is affordable to the poorest households just because the deals don't pencil. So the poorest households, the households that Diane was talking about, who are making $25,000, $20,000 a year, the amount of money that they can afford to spend every month in rent isn't enough to cover even the basic operating costs, not just of a brand new apartment, but even of an older building. So it just costs landlords a certain amount to keep the lights on, to maintain the building, to pay for property management, and so forth. Low-income households can't pay enough to make that worthwhile, and so there's a gap there that needs to be made up by subsidy that comes from the government. If local governments allowed developers to build more apartments, and Charlotte is actually one of the places that's building better than most places, so you guys are sort of on the high end of the spectrum. But if developers could build more market-rate apartments, there would be less competition between sort of middle and moderate-income households and poor households for the existing housing that's cheapest. So part of the problem is we're just not building enough housing even for middle-income households, and then we're making matters worse for families who are even poorer.
So does this require, Diane, more than federal subsidies? Does it require the federal government to pass some sort of a law that mandates that states and local municipalities have the ability to change those zoning ordinances and things like that?
Well, I think that would be hard to do. I think that it would be hard to get the number of members of Congress that you would need to pass a law like that to be willing to say what state and local governments must do with their local zoning. But there are increasingly conversations about, one, understanding just how significant a problem this is and how many communities are unwilling to make any changes to their local zoning regulations, and often unwilling because there is at the center of this whole conversation a conversation about race. And sometimes, if not often, about racism and about othering and not wanting, you know, those people to live in our community and wanting to keep it exclusive, not change the nature or the type of community that people live in. So you hear a lot of sort of coded language about why people want to keep communities exactly as they are, not allow for more apartments. So as conversations around fair housing move forward, and as the housing crisis worsens, I think there's increasing understanding at the federal level that something needs to be done, whether it's to incentivize or, in some cases, to require local communities to do more. And the way that you do that is by tying some type of, whether it's an incentive or a requirement, to federal dollars that those local communities want and need. So there's been some conversations about creating such incentives or requirements around housing dollars, which is a good start to the conversation, but even better when we think more broadly about the big dollars that local communities get through transportation dollars, or if there were any infrastructure dollars. potentially tying some requirements or incentives, again, for local communities to be able to get those dollars, they have to be willing to start to remove some of those restrictive zoning.
But would that work in a city like Charlotte, in a state like North Carolina, where Charlotte, as a municipality, is not allowed to tell developers you must allocate X number of units in your new building to affordable housing? We're not permitted to do that. We can only provide incentives. So wouldn't we have to walk away from whatever federal money we get for increasing the stock of affordable housing because we can't do it?
Well, ultimately, those decisions, right, around zoning and around incentives for affordable housing are local decisions. So there's sort of two different things here. One are the federal subsidies that are needed to make homes affordable for the lowest income people. States and localities are in many ways doing their best to make up for the huge gap that the federal government left when it walked away from its commitments to keeping people affordably housed. And state and local governments have been finding creative ways to kind of tax themselves or find other resources to subsidize those lowest income renters. Another issue is what state and local governments can or should do to require more affordable housing be built through, as you're saying, inclusionary zoning is one way to do that, or the removing those restrictive zoning laws. Again, unless there's some tie to federal dollars, those are ultimately state and local decisions.
So, Jenny, the bottom line here is it's an economic issue. So how, even if you have all these regulations that favor the building of affordable housing, how do you convince people, developers, owners, to build and supply that affordable housing when their bottom line is what they're most concerned about?
Well, for for-profit developers, the way to get them to build below market rate units is to give them a subsidy. So, you know, developers always have the option to not build, and if the deal doesn't pencil, they just won't. Including if the deal doesn't pencil in one locality because they're being required to build a bunch of below market units, they can walk across the street to the next jurisdiction that doesn't require that and build something, you know, build the same product but make higher profit. But Charlotte is a good example to think about how we could have done things differently around the development of the light rail line. So all of the light rail subway projects come with federal dollars. Imagine if before that project got approved, before the money got allocated from the federal level to build it, the federal government said local governments have to revise their zoning so that every place within, say, a half mile of the new light rail stations has to be zoned to allow apartments by right so that they can be built relatively quickly and cheaply. And we're going to allocate a special number of housing vouchers so that all of the new buildings that get created within walking distance of the station have, for instance, you know, vouchers that can cover 10% of the units. So you could imagine aligning the federal housing subsidies and the federal transportation subsidies and using that as a carrot to incentivize better land use in the places that would offer people opportunity because they're then closer to these transportation centers.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we will take a look at the two plans proposed by Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden in this presidential campaign season. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. If you're looking for more conversations around local and national politics, then look no further than Inside Politics, the RNC in Charlotte. WFAE's new podcast covering the RNC and the 2020 presidential race through the lens of Charlotte. Listen to Inside Politics, the RNC in Charlotte on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org/insidepolitics. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Politics Monday, we're focusing on affordable housing today and the fact that it's come up, but historically come up for the first time, but not a lot in this presidential campaign, although the two remaining Democratic candidates each have plans, which we're going to talk about right now. With Jenny Schutz, fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program, Future of the Middle Class Initiative at the Brookings Institution. She joins us from studios there. Diane Yentel is the president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. She's joining us by phone. Diane, all of the Democratic candidates had plans of one form or another to address this problem. Some were focused on policy and programs. Indeed, several Democratic candidates called your organization for help in crafting solutions that they were proposing, things like altering zoning codes, incentives for developers, things like that. And many of these candidates had plans involving spending lots of money. Did any of them compare to Bernie Sanders' proposal to spend $1 trillion or more?
No, his is by far the most ambitious and the most expensive. You're right that we've worked with all of the candidates to urge them to put forward their solutions to the housing crisis. And in the recommendations that we give them for what it would take to solve the housing crisis, there are four solutions. One is to preserve and build homes that are affordable to the lowest income people, and we do that through investments in programs like the National Housing Trust Fund, which was created precisely to make homes affordable to the lowest income people, to provide rental assistance to help people who can't afford the rent to bridge the gap between what they earn and what rent costs. And rental assistance can take the form of expanded Section 8 vouchers or through a renter's tax credit. To prevent families from facing evictions in the first place with cash assistance program, and then a whole bucket of solutions around protecting renters from discrimination and abuse. And so I would say that all of the candidates, as you said, we had 15 candidates put forward solutions, their plans for the housing crisis, and all of them included some of those buckets of solutions, and a few of the candidates proposed all solutions from all of those buckets. And where the candidates' proposals differ from each other, it's primarily a matter of scale. So, for example, as you said, Bernie Sanders proposes $148 billion a year for the National Housing Trust Fund, and Joe Biden proposes $2 billion a year for that same program. So a really significant difference in scale while there's an agreement on the need to expand that program.
And Jenny, you say there's an overlap also about where they're doing well. How can I put this? Diverging strategies between Bernie and Biden, which points toward their appeal in different states. Explain that.
Sure. So not surprisingly, Bernie's is much more ambitious, not just with the scale, but sort of the extent to which the government would regulate what we typically think of as mostly kind of a private market. So most people in the U.S. live in housing that has been built by private sector developers, in rental units that are owned by private landlords. And so the contracts between landlords and tenants are mostly, you know, private parties agreeing to this, and landlord-tenant law is generally regulated by state governments and not by the federal government. You know, Bernie, one of the sort of the notable things in his plan is that he's recommending something that looks like a national rent regulation law that would cap the amount of the rent increase private sector landlords could charge their private market tenants. That's something that's really well outside the scope of anything we've seen before. Only a handful of cities and states have had something similar. So a national rent regulation law is a much more sort of public sector forward program. You know, he also is proposing substantially more investment in traditional public housing, which is something we really haven't been building since the 1970s. Biden's plan is much more market-oriented. Let's take the existing framework. Let's tweak some things that aren't working. For instance, more rigorous enforcement of fair housing laws, but not let's fundamentally go away from a market-driven housing market to something where the public sector takes a much larger role.
Well, a lot of Bernie's plans are revolutionary. They would change the way things work completely. They would turn almost everything upside down. Is that something that's a good thing, or is that something that would simply be stopped in Congress and never be passed, no matter who controls the Congress?
It's pretty hard to imagine the more sort of public sector oriented parts of Bernie's plan getting passed. I mean, I don't see an appetite even among most of the Democrats in Congress for national rent regulation. It's not actually clear to me how many of the housing authority directors want to be building more new public housing since they really don't have funds to maintain and manage what they have already. So I think some of this is a strong signaling to his left base, you know, let's think about a bigger public role in this, but I don't think most of these are politically realistic or financially feasible.
And you say that Bernie's antagonism toward for-profit landlords plays well in California, where he has a tremendous amount of support. Biden, or at least we thought he had a tremendous amount of support before the Super Tuesday primary, and I think he came in very close to Biden there. And Joe Biden's attention to racial disparities in all of this plays well here in the South, where a lot of his support comes from because of the African-American population. Diane, you keep bringing up this National Housing Trust Fund, and I'm not sure people know what that is. What is it? When was it established? What does it do?
Oh, sure. Yeah, the National Housing Trust Fund is one of our country's newest affordable housing programs. It was created in 2008, And it was created to fill the gap of lack of affordable apartments for the lowest income people. So it's at its current funding level, which this year will be about $350 million nationally, at its current funding level, 100% of the dollars go to build and preserve homes, apartments that are affordable for extremely low-income people. So the first year's funding allocation was in 2016. There was a gap between when the law was passed and when the funding actually started to flow. But that first year's allocation of about $176 million nationally has created 2,000 apartments across the country that are housing extremely low-income and often very vulnerable people, people who were formerly chronically homeless, youth experiencing homelessness, veterans who have disabilities from fighting in wars, people fleeing domestic violence, and so on. And so there's an understanding at this point that this program is very important. It fills a critical need, and it needs to be vastly expanded to actually meet the existing need. So in our recommendations to all the candidates and to members of Congress, we propose expanding it to $40 billion a year so that it can meet the need. And many of the candidates in their proposals came in at around that amount. As we said earlier, Joe Biden came in much lower, and Bernie Sanders proposes much higher.
So, Jenny, Bernie proposes investing $1.48 trillion over 10 years in that fund to build 7.4 million units, and he wants to invest an additional $400 billion to build 2 million mixed-income social housing units. Would that put a dent in the problem?
Well, if we could come up with that kind of money, that would certainly produce a lot more housing. But I will say that we can't just, money alone is not the problem. So when we were talking about the kinds of regulations that limit new apartments, that also limits where you're allowed to build subsidized housing. So in a community that bans market rate apartments, you can't build a social housing project. You can't build a low-income housing tax credit building. You can't build apartments where landlords might be able to take Section 8 vouchers. So in some sense, throwing a bunch of extra subsidied money at communities that don't allow you to build enough market rate housing isn't going to solve the problem unless you really deal with the underlying supply constraints.
Hold on just a second. Define social housing units.
Well, that's actually a little bit of a fuzzy term. So usually in the U.S., we think about either public housing units, which are built with federal dollars, owned by local housing authorities, managed by public entities, so they are fully publicly owned and run. Or we think of these units that are built by sometimes either for-profit or not-for-profit developers, but that have some federal subsidy attached. So the low-income housing tax credit is our major production program. We don't usually use the term social housing that much in the U.S. That's more typically used in Europe. And it could be either sort of this publicly owned housing or subsidized housing with some restrictions, but owned by, for instance, a nonprofit developer.
So, Diane, Joe Biden wants to guarantee Section 8 housing choice vouchers to every eligible household so they do not have to pay more than 30% of their incomes on rent and utilities. But a lot of landlords don't take Section 8 vouchers. How big a stumbling block is that?
It can be a big one, you're right. In some communities, we see very high percentages of people who, once they finally receive their Section 8 voucher after waiting months, years, can't find a landlord who will accept it. And increasingly in local communities, or now actually of late, more increasingly statewide, there are laws being passed that prohibit what are called source of income discrimination. In other words, you can't say, I'm not going to rent you my apartment just because you have a Section 8 voucher. And that kind of change is also needed at the national level to have national source of income discrimination protections so that when we expand the Section 8 voucher program, as we need to, people will actually be able to use those vouchers and rent apartments.
Joe Biden also advocates investing $300 million in grants to incentivize local communities to eliminate exclusionary zoning policies. What are they, Jenny, and how prevalent are they?
Things like the bans on apartments that we've been talking about, processes that make it more difficult to build housing, particularly for low-income people. And those policies are basically universal. I mean, large cities, suburbs, small towns, every community in the U.S. makes it harder to build multifamily buildings than single-family detached homes, even though multifamily buildings are going to be the more affordable and accessible type of housing. So this really is a nationwide problem that at some point we're going to have to address.
And Diane, he wants to allocate $5 billion in federal funding for a renter's tax credit each year to help families and individuals who make too much money to qualify for Section 8 vouchers but still struggle with housing costs. And he wants to address homelessness in his proposals by investing $13 billion over 5 years. Are either of those sums for either of those tasks enough?
Well, they could be if they were combined with some of the other proposals in his plan. And there's no silver bullet answer to the affordable housing crisis. And even when it comes to federal funding, there's no single program that, if it were expanded, would end homelessness and housing poverty. There's a variety of solutions that are needed. And both Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden really hit on the top issues, the top programs that need expanded funding. Again, expanding funding to build apartments affordable to the lowest income people, expanding rental assistance, expanding renter protections, looking at ways for local governments to remove exclusionary zoning that prohibits any apartments from being built, and prohibiting discrimination. Both of the proposals have something from each of those set of solutions, which is we have to look at it as a whole in order to say whether it would be enough to solve the crisis.
So I have 30 seconds left, Jenny, and there's an intersection with this problem and the coronavirus, as we're about to find out in a lot of different arenas. What is that intersection?
Sure. So we're talking about now proposals for people to self-quarantine, to stay at home for 2 weeks in order not to expose themselves and others to the virus. But imagine, we've got a bunch of people who are unhoused. We have a bunch of people who are doubled up living with family and friends and sleeping on the couch. We have people who are living in overcrowded apartments. Imagine how much harder it's going to be for families in those situations to stockpile 2 weeks' worth of supplies when often they can't afford to buy a week's worth of groceries at a time, and to confine themselves to really crowded conditions or, in some cases, not having a stable place to live. So for people who are not stably housed and affordably housed, asking them to self-quarantine for 2 weeks is just not going to be practical.
Jenny Schutz is a fellow in the Metropolitan Policy Program, Future of Middle Class Initiative at the Brookings Institution, and Diane Yentel is the president and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Thank you both for the conversation. Before you go, did you make that contribution to WFAE? If you did, thanks. If not, it only takes a second, and you decide the amount. Hit the donate button on the WFAE app or at WFAE.org. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.